This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 281 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Okay, well, I'm in Fort Washington. Screwed that up already.
Close enough.
Hey, Max, how are we?
I'm good. Kind of tired. Went down to the Wings Club luncheon today in New York City and listened to a great talk by the CEO of Aireon, talking about their supersonic aircraft plans. It was kind of neat. I think we'll talk about that in an upcoming Airplane Geeks episode, I think.
That's good. And Max, we should break out the news to everybody. Max is going on a road trip. So next week, it's going to be I and a special guest. Hopefully, she is so excited to be on the show, she's already started prepping show notes for next week.
Well, that's good.
We wish Max safe travels as he goes to Sun and Fun, and I'm sure he'll get at least one drone interview down there because I believe there's going to be a drone cage. So hopefully he'll come back with some content for us.
Yes, I will try.
He's on the road again, and we're looking forward to hearing about all of his adventures. So Max, we got to get going because you got to start editing. So let's go with the first story, shall we?
All right, David, let's launch with it.
OSU receives first FAA authorization to fly unmanned aircraft in groups. OSU is Oklahoma State University, and they received FAA approval to fly drone swarms. That's pretty cool.
That is cool. And not only that, these are fixed wing drone swarms, which is something that I don't think we've ever looked at that. It's a more difficult problem, I think, than multi-rotors.
Yeah, absolutely, because multi-rotors, you can keep in the swarm and hold them in a tight area. Fixed wing, that's a whole different thing. That means the smallest space you could turn would be the radius of the swarm. So really intricate details involved with this. One pilot, visual observers, and up to 20 fixed wing drones. I think, Max, you're right. It's going to be quite the interesting sight to see as we watch 20 drones formate.
And this is something that OSU has been working on for quite a while, apparently. 4 years they've been looking at this kind of research for fixed wing aircraft. So I think that's pretty impressive. Look forward to seeing how they make out with that. One of the things that they mentioned, this comes from the professor, OSU professor Jamie Jacob, he noted that there is, and this makes sense, there is a lot more computing power required for fixed wings, and a lot of development of the algorithm that's a little bit more challenging. So that's good. I don't know if anybody else is working on this. I don't recall offhand hearing about any other swarm activity going on for fixed wings. But this will be really, really interesting to see how this progresses.
Well, we know that DARPA is looking at fixed wing swarms, but this is a much more practical, closer to realization project. We've talked about loyal wingmen on the show, but that's one aircraft maybe directing two associate drones. 20 drones, and the implication is it's got to be beyond visual line of sight, Max. I mean, they're going to get away from you real quick.
Yeah, you would think so, yes. Although they do mention this requirement for visual observers. So, maybe you have a situation where they're out of line of sight of the single operator, but maybe there are visual observers sprinkled about, as it were, so that they
downrange.
Downrange. That sounds better than sprinkled about, I think.
We'll let you go with sprinkled about.
Yeah. Yeah. But I can imagine doing something like, even something as simple with air quotes as surveying crops or something. Now, we normally see a single drone in a pattern back and forth to cover the land. But if you had a whole collection of fixed wing drones, you could survey an awful large area pretty quickly. So maybe that's one kind of a possible application. I'm sure there's a lot of others, but...
Well, to dovetail off of your application, how about a disaster area?
Ah, there we go.
To be able to any sort of large-scale surveying, whether it be crops and precision agriculture or the disaster area, where you could have one man operating 20 drones, flying them, and that would provide real-time coverage very quickly. So we really want to follow this story because I think this is a very fascinating way to handle drones. And swarm seems to be one of those things that we would have never thought about. But, bees, swarms, drones, they go together.
They do. Yeah, swarms are my second favorite drone topic, I think.
And the first is?
Oh, you know what it is. Fuel cells. Yeah. If somebody comes along with fuel cell powered drone swarms, then I'll just be in heaven. All right. What's next, David?
Okay. Sorry, I have to stop laughing at that one. The next one is from the national.ae. UAE aims to develop next generation of drones for fighting fires and to cope with fog. Where there's smoke, there's fire and fog, and it's kind of hard to fly in weather, even if you're a pilot. I mean, a drone needs to fly in that environment too. So it looks like Khalifa University in Abu Dhabi is trying to make them stronger, lighter, and weather resistant. So these are things that now that we're thinking about persistence in drones, we need to worry about.
Yeah, this is really a materials story, which we'll get to here in just a second. But sort of the motivation behind this and where this firefighting comes in is kind of interesting. There have been some seriously fatal fires in some high-rise buildings. Some of what we've seen has taken place in the UAE, some fires there. There was a big building fire in London. And the one of the researchers here was really struck by trying to find a solution that would help in situations like that. And if you're looking at firefighting drones, as you're saying, David, you want to be able to operate in these adverse conditions. You probably want to be able to carry heavy loads. There's some other considerations where if you can make the drone as light as possible, that increases the payload capacity of the drone. So what he's developed here, what they've developed, is a composite, a sandwich kind of a structure, which we see in aviation, in aerospace. We see honeycomb structures being used. But this is kind of an interesting one. In the middle, in the center of this sandwich, is a low-density material that's 3D printed, which is very interesting. And there he's using ABS, which is a common thermoplastic. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the scientific words that make up ABS.
Acronitrate butylene.
Wow. And the S is styrene. That one's easy.
Yeah, well, it comes from those years of me working with plastics in my hobby of, ABS is one of the plastics you use when you build plastic models, or you get into advanced plastic models and you start doing things like scratch building. And also in in a lot of plastic architectural models, they use ABS, so you have to use different glues. So yeah, believe it or not, I was actually excited about this, including the 3D printing.
Yeah, it's easy to, easy to 3D print this kind of plastic. And so that's the center core of this sandwich. And then the outer part is carbon fiber reinforced polymer, or CFRP. And so with that kind of material, it's incredibly light, incredibly strong. And the idea here is that, you know, you construct the components of the drone out of this, which will yield a much, much lighter drone.
And the university wants to market these as firefighting drones, which, of course, would be a good thing. I mean, and to be able to access a fire or to assist delivering fire retardant materials or fire retardant at higher levels is really important. I mean, the buildings in the Middle East on the Gulf are extremely tall. I mean, and safety concerns. I get onto the 10th floor of my current building and I start thinking about how do I get downstairs. So fires at altitude, drones might be save the day at some point.
Now, of course, we talk about firefighting drones made out of plastic. An obvious question is,
how do they not melt?
How do they not melt? So they're thinking about that as well, and possibly doing something like adding a thin ceramic layer to the outside that would be heat resistant. So that that's something that they're intending to look at. And they also mentioned that they might even consider things like swarms of firefighting drones. So here we go with swarms again.
And Max, What vehicle made famous ceramic heat-resistant tiles?
Oh, the space shuttle.
See, so we're talking about an older technology.
Yeah.
One that had some problems, but still, it's an aviation prospect. So good for the UAE and another good drones for good story. But Max, you know, one of the things that I like talking about besides fuel cells and swarms is I love it when we get a story about women in aviation, or in this case, women in drones. And this was from dronesbelow.com, my new favorite website for our Australian listeners. Future female pilots train with drones and the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
That's right. The RFDS, they're helping schoolgirls become drone pilots. And they're working with an Australian STEM specialist that's called SheMaps, which is at SheMaps.com. And they organize drone workshops for girls, I guess, your youngsters. And they have some really interesting and I would say shocking statistics about STEM.
Yeah, I'm glad you highlighted these in the show notes. They were kind of, I don't want to say troubling, but it's a challenge that we need to work beyond. One of them is 2/3 of children aged 9 to 11, when asked to draw a scientist, draw a man.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, 16% of university and vet STEM graduates are female.
Yeah, just 16%.
And about 6% of aviation pilots in Australia are female, and about 1% of drone pilots are female. We got to work on that. Australia, you need to get your girls up in the air.
I wonder, in the United States, we see a number pretty close to that same 6% for the portion of aviation pilots that are female. You see different numbers, sometimes as low as 4, but between 4 and 6%. But I've never seen a statistic for the percentage of drone pilots in the United States that are female. I wonder if it tracks to, you know, about the same 1% as they're reporting here in Australia. That'd be an interesting statistic to learn. But yeah, so this is great. Apparently, CMAPS and the Royal Flying Doctor Service haven't collaborated in the past, so this is something new. They're going to be using the RFDS hangar in Rockhampton, although they probably have a better way to pronounce Rockhampton. Rockhampton?
Our Australian listeners, please let us know. Rockhampton probably is better, but you guys probably do anglicize it or Australianize it. But what I wanted to say is, for a lot of our listeners, I don't know if you know about the Royal Doctor Flying Service, but it has been around since the early 1900s. And basically, it was pilots and doctors who would fly the outback to provide medical services to the remote farms and ranches in Australia, since there's so much out there that is outback. The Royal Flying Doctor Service has always been one of my favorite organizations because it's the ultimate flying charity, and it's been around forever, and it did a very important service. And the fact that it's spreading its goal now to encourage women to be part of that is also really kind of awesome. So good to CMAPS and the Royal Flying Doctor Service and our friends down under.
And I have a little homework assignment for those of you listening who might like a chuckle or at least a nice smile. If you have a chance, go visit CMAPS.com, look at the About page, and scroll down and check out their chief testing officer. And I won't say any more, but if you want to smile, just do that. All right, David, what's next?
I guess we got to call this one on your grounded file. The Christmas holiday season wasn't good to drone operators, at least at Gatwick and Heathrow. Well, this was from commercialdroneprofessionals.com. Gatwick Airport Christmas chaos totals £459,000 UK in police costs.
Mm.
This just kills our rep as an industry. I don't know what else to say. The cost to Surrey police, £40,000 sterling, and the Sussex police, £419,000 sterling. And all of that, what were the results, Max?
Never found the drones. They had more than 100 drone sightings over the course of 3 days. What was it? Was it a drone? Was it one drone? Was it more than one drone? Don't know. Over 140,000 passengers had flight disruptions as a result of that. So, yeah, it's a lot of money. And if at least there had been some kind of law enforcement result, that probably would have been good, would have helped justify it. But maybe what it'll do is motivate law enforcement and airports to, develop plans and methods for dealing with these kinds of drone incursions. They're maybe a little bit more efficient than was the case at Gatwick.
So, yeah, sorry to report, but we have to report the good and the bad. And this is one of those challenges. And counter UAS, told you at the beginning of the year that was going to be one of the big topics this year, is counter UAS. And this is an example of why, unfortunately, we need counter UAS, especially at high priority places like airports and professional buildings, etc.
Yes, yes.
So our next story comes from our writer of wildlife stories, and it's not really about wildlife, but wildlife-esque. I actually found this story kind of fascinating. We've talked about perching over the years, but we haven't talked about hanging or clinging. In this case, it's a video from Inverse.com. A video shows a drone with talons that hangs upside down like a bat. Finally, Max, we've come in this 50th anniversary of Batman. We have now a bat drone.
Is this the 50th anniversary of Batman?
It is.
You know, there's a lot of 50th and similar anniversaries this year.
Or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's more than that, but it this year is an anniversary for Batman.
Okay. Well, this is another example of science imitating nature, or maybe engineering imitating nature. And I always love those kinds of things too. And so if you know anything about bats, you know that they can pretty much cling anywhere. And so the idea here is, what if you can develop a drone that has similar kinds of characteristics? So this comes from Yale University. This quadcopter has these gripper fingers, three long gripper fingers on the quadcopter, and it can perch, like you say, David, we've talked about before, but it can also rest. And that's got quotes on it, on ledges or poles or scaffoldings. And what they're saying is that that could be a useful energy-saving method, which I had to think about that a little bit. And I think what they're saying is that if you've got a drone on a mission, or a multi-rotor, on a mission of some kind, it doesn't necessarily mean that it needs to be airborne the whole time. So when there are periods where it could, quote, rest and therefore not consume so much battery power, that would extend the flight duration of the drone, which I think is pretty interesting.
And folks, I'll admit it. I Googled it. I was wrong. It's the 80th anniversary of Batman.
Oh, my gosh. So,
1939.
Wow.
But that's not what we're talking about. But yeah, there is something kind of Batman-esque about a drone clinging to a side of a wall. If you're as old as Max and I, you remember Batman climbing up the walls in the television series. But just hanging there, taking a breath, and then getting ready to do the mission again. Or in some cases, maybe just sitting there and watching and listening, or brooding over Gotham City.
Brooding.
Yeah. When Miss Heather sent me this story, I got really excited. There was a lot. It was a really cool story. And I think, Max, over the last couple of years, both you and I do like we follow nature stories that comes up with drones, that nature does it best. How can we imitate it? So. And there's been a lot of those.
And as you mentioned at the beginning of this story, David, this has a video that shows what this is like. And it's kind of interesting to see a multi-rotor, a quadcopter, grab onto a pole and hang underneath it, just like a bat would. It's kind of I don't know, it's not creepy, but it is kind of an odd thing to see. Very unusual anyway. So, of course, there's always more work to be done. And in this case at Yale, one thing they want to look at is the ability for this kind of a drone to self-detect resting spots so that this would have a level of autonomy so that it could actually identify situations where, okay, I don't need to keep flying right now. I can become stationary, and rather than land, find a spot that it can grab onto and hang from until it needs to resume its flight or whatever mission it was on. So that's coming up for these guys in Yale.
So very cool. Thanks to our executive producer for Wildlife Stories on that one. Well, Max, I thought doing this show, I could escape the news of Boeing and the 787 MAX.
He means 737 MAX.
Until this morning, and this story popped up, that the reason for the 787 MAX issues...
He means 737 MAX.
...is because of drones.
I know.
This was... Every pilot that when we first started this show's nightmare, evidently it's the drones that causes the major airliners failure. I just couldn't believe it. And this was from TheDailyBeast.com. FAA turned over more safety work to Boeing under pressure to regulate drones. It's always the drone's fault, Max.
This comes from Clive Irving. And in this piece, he says the FAA is handing off certification work to aircraft manufacturers like Boeing because of pressure on the agency to keep up with the rapidly growing drone industry. Now, if you're following the 787 MAX story, you know that I mean 737 MAX. Now he's got me doing it. One of the issues is this certification issue, and should the plane have been certified the way it was? What has the role of Boeing been in the certification process, and so on and so forth? So this writer is saying that there's a connection there with drones. Now, he says, while there's no direct evidence that the pressure may have hampered the FAA's role in certifying the 737 MAX and the anti-stall system suspected of bringing down the jets, it is clearly, that's his word, clearly one reason that the FAA ceded part of the work to Boeing in 2017 when the agency gave final certification to the MAX. So his evidence here is that the FAA's 2017 budget request said that its aviation office, quote, would need additional staffing to meet growing demands for UAS operations while continuing to expand delegation responsibilities to designees, that being like Boeing. So I don't know. Is it a stretch? Can we tell if it's a stretch?
I don't know if it is a stretch or not. I mean, it's they did delegate the authority to Boeing.
But that's the way it works.
Yeah, I know. And what I'm going to say is, I think everybody, if you want to listen to more about this story, you need to listen to our last Airplane Geeks podcast, episode 545, where we delve into the 787 story, as well as our other family podcast, Mary Kirby's Runway Girl podcast. Both of those are produced elegantly and thoroughly by my co-host, Max. But and we'll have links to those two shows and episodes in the show notes because they give you different perspectives. I really was sort of surprised that we in the drone industry would be getting sucked into the 787 argument, but
737.
The 737 MAX 8 argument, where they're looking to find answers that maybe aren't readily available. And this is just one more, I don't want to say grasping at straws because there's something there, but I hope that this kind of theory dissipates quickly.
Yeah, this was not something that I saw coming. David, and when I think this morning when I was down at the Wings Club in New York City, I think I saw, you know, a notification come through, maybe your comment to someone else on the story or something like that, where I could see that there was some kind of a linkage between the 737 MAX issues and drones, and I'm thinking, where could that possibly come from?
Well, somebody took the time to put the pieces together. They may be using a lot of extra glue and forcing round pegs into square holes. But that being said, it's important for us to discuss it because we've been discussing it on our other shows. And it was a good way to tell you that you really should listen to our other shows too, besides just us, because you might learn something that directly affects our industry. I'm hoping that this doesn't get caught on with the mainstream media because then things might get ugly. And we don't really want that. We have enough bad stuff happening that and implied stuff that this is just one thing that's just another stretch. So, but again, episode 545 of Airplane Geeks and the last episode of the Runway Girl podcast. Listen to them and you might be surprised about what you didn't know and what you should know about the 737 MAX 8 from first people.
Right, including the captain of that airplane. All right. Well, David, I think enough of that. Let's wrap it up for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. Thanks for the feedback you send us. Yeah, you can find our webpage, of course, at theuavdigest.com. Show notes for this episode are at theuavdigest.com/281.
And, of course, you can find us both on LinkedIn, David Vanderhoof and Max Flight. We've been perusing that a lot more intensely lately. You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook at UAV Digest. And of course, you can buy some swag at our Cafe Press store. And of course, you can definitely meet and greet and socialize electronically with our Slack listener team. And you can do that by sending us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com. So with that, I want to say thank you, Heather, for your stories. And I want to say thank you all for listening. This is David in Fort Washington.
And Max in Hartford.
And soon to be in Florida and Georgia and other various states. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.